changes in the brain by its sibling.
Yeah.
Is it found in every siblings of autistic
child? That's a good question. To different degrees. Now, undoubtedly, not every sibling shows this, because we know that in some people with autism, the autism is a result of new mutations in one or just a few genes that are unique to that particular person. But more often than not, more frequently than not, it is a combination of many, many genes and many environmental factors. And so some, but not all, of those genes will be shared by people who are by people in the same families who are not autistic. So in most of the siblings, we find this effect to one degree or another. Not all of them. And here's the interesting thing. The degree of delay in that frontal brain activation actually correlates with measures of autistic cognitive and personality traits. Not just in the people with autism, but also in the unaffected siblings. So the unaffected siblings who have more autistic traits, behaviors and cognition more similar to their autistic siblings, they have more delayed peaks in that brain activation. So there's this lovely correspondence between the physiology and the behavior.
Will it affect their learning?
Will it affect their learning?
Shown that they are almost normal brain connection. That last graph,
yep.
You have shown there's almost normal brain connection as it is in normal brain. Mm-hmm. It is saying almost same or slightly lower in siblings. Will it affect their learning process?
Absolutely it will. Just as any brain variation affects learning processes in any human being. Every child has a different way of learning. Whether that child is autistic or non-autistic. Every autistic child has a different learning style. Every non-autistic child has a different learning style. And there are just as many individual brains and individual learning styles as there are individual children. So yes, that brain difference will affect the learning style, but it will affect the learning style in everyone. Now, some things you may find, and I was actually, I was just talking with one parent today. Let me actually talk a bit about myself, which is atypical for a scientific talk, but the parent with whom I was speaking this morning, when she described her non-autistic son, I had to smile because it was so familiar from personal experience. And a lot of times, you know, we just, especially here in South Asia, a lot of schools, not this one, obviously, but a lot of them, the school will not adapt to the individual child. Instead, the school will seek to teach the perfect, ideal child, right? And of course, no child is ideal in all regards. And so schools will always be this sort of awkward fit to the children that they're trying to teach. Well, yeah, so all of the silent sufferings and agonies that children go through, and we know, you know, we're oblivious. We know nothing about what's happening to them. So when I was a schoolboy, being a sibling of someone with autism, well, I had certain traits, and I still have some of them. Okay, I foul up and I trip over power cables and knock over screens, right? I've never been particularly agile. But it was worse when I was a schoolboy. I was in primary school in America, and we had this game called kickball. And it was absolutely awful because, you know, they would bowl this ball at you, and you had to run up and make your foot connect with it and kick. I can never make my foot connect with the ball. Right? No, not once. Yeah, and then it gets worse. If you're in the outfield, right, then somebody kicks the ball, you have to catch it. I could never catch it. Right? You know, and every time it would be, you know, the ball's coming, I close my arms, it bounces off. Or the ball's coming, it drops through my arms, then I close them. Yeah, I could never catch it. So, of course, yeah, this creates a social stigma. I got chosen last for absolutely every team. There would be a queue to decide, you know, who was going to kick. And I always tried subtly to cut back in the queue until the teacher noticed and bring me up. And then I would miss the kick. And in the outfield, you know, I would try to gauge where the ball was going to come and then subtly move away from that position so that somebody else could do it. Right? We had to do these jumping jack exercises, you know, these things, right?
Yes.
I could not do that. I could do this, or I could do this. I couldn't get the two. Yeah. So the point is, you know, we expect children, or most mainstream schools expect children to be able to do these things. You know, and the teacher's attitude is, well, everybody knows how to do that. Come on, right? Some people can't do them. And I had terrible motor control difficulties, a lot like my brothers. Not as severe, but similar. Again, you know, my brother and I, we very much spoke the same language, as it were, when it came to sensory perception. So if you look at this light, okay, you see the dust flakes in the light?
Yes.
My brother and I could stare at this for ages, right? When I was small, just like look at the patterns of dust and then... And look how it responds to your breath. And we could spend like an hour, right? You know, Akabar, Dutabar. Yeah. So nobody really clued in to that detail orientation that I had. Another example, we had an old television set, you know, the kind with the tubes in instead of the transistors, right? And so the tubes would hum, right? Right? And the interesting thing was, if you put a television in a room, the way the sound reflects off the walls changes the interference pattern, and therefore the volume and the tone that you hear as the position of your ear moves closer and farther away to the source. So my brother and I both could sit in front of the television and just like, right? And there was this great correspondence between the visual flow of the room when you go back and forth and the vestibular input and the change in the pitch from those tubes in the television set. And that was fascinating because you could explore it in all of its parameters. How does the pitch change? How does the sound change depending on the position of my head? What is the parametric correspondence between those two factors, the level of the sound and the position of the head? It was a kind of fascination with exploring correspondences within the environment, with developing scientific hypotheses, and then testing those hypotheses. When I was a child, you know, we had this, so there's this imaginary figure of Father Christmas, right, that comes and gives children presents, right? I developed a hypothesis that, you know, what people described about Father Christmas, and that he visits absolutely every household, you know, on this one night, it can't possibly be true because there's no physical way to do it. So I decided I would test that hypothesis I tell my parents, okay, I want to write a letter to him. He must have an address if he's real, you know, and they were like, why don't you let us take your letter to the post office? I said, no, I can do it. The point is, both my brother and I were experimentalists. We were both scientifically minded. We both enjoyed developing hypotheses about the world and then examining those hypotheses by experiment and manipulation of behavior to see whether they were correct. And they could be as simple as hypotheses about the ways in which an air current will flow if I blow into it. Or they could be as complex as hypotheses about whether or not Father Christmas exists, and if so, whether he has an address, right? We both thought the same scientific way. Now the difference is, he did not have spoken language. He developed a great deal of receptive language, but he could not speak. And it was years and years, he was in his late 30s before he began typing, just because nobody had ever sat him in front of a keyboard and tried it. So he had great trouble communicating. He could do picture exchange, he could do signs of single nouns and verbs, but that was it. Yeah, he could take people's hands and put them on things, right, obviously. So in him, that fascination with experiment and with cause and effect and with detail, that stuck at the level of blowing into dust beams or watching ceiling fans or flicking light switches and looking for the cause and effect. With me, that became elaborated into designing a scientific experiment and observing the outcome, mixing two chemicals and seeing what happened, writing a computer program and given the inputs, predicting the outputs. The pleasure that he and I derived from that ability to predict and to control the universe around us was the same pleasure. And the frustrations that he and I both faced at people who expected us to be able to do certain things when we really couldn't, that was the same frustration. Now, it was different, vastly different in degree, but not in kind. And my brother, now that he has learnt how to type, he uses a great deal of metaphor to describe his experiences. And one of the metaphors that he uses is that communication steers his boat to shore. And nutty autistic brain, this is the phrase that he tends to use, nutty autistic brain, blows his boat out to sea. So in that metaphor, I think, you know, I am a person who is maybe standing chest deep in the shallows right offshore, right? Able to communicate with the boat, or able to feel and to see a bit about what the boat is experiencing, but still able to stand on solid ground. And I think that, yes, absolutely, these semi-autistic or pseudo-autistic brain differences that you find in siblings, they do affect what is appropriate for education. And they ought to affect expectations. You know, a lot of siblings have motor trouble. A lot of siblings are very, very detail-oriented. They get focused, they get fixed, and then, you know, their attention is, you know, they won't notice things that are going on around them. I'll give you another example. I was in the second year of primary school. I had an art class, and I was always rubbish at art. Because one thing, you would have to, they wanted you to make pictures of people, and I just didn't know how to do people. I could do color charts, that was good. I enjoyed mixing the colors to see, you know, what kinds of combinations I could get, but I couldn't do people. Anyway, so they had this activity, you go, you had a row of desks, and you had, you know, paint here, and you had glitter here, and you had glue here, and a string in, all these different stations. And you have to walk up and down from one station to the next to get all your materials together, yeah? Okay. And so there I am, and I have a very, very fixated idea of what I want on this piece of paper. And I'm going from station to station to station, putting things in. And then all of a sudden, I find the art teacher glaring at me, and I'm thinking, and she looks down, and I look down, and someone of my classmates at some point had spilt some paint on the floor. And I had been going up and down from station to station with my attention rigidly fixated on the desks, you know, and not at all noticing the floor that I'm walking across. And of course, I've tracked this white paint all along, right, all over. And so from the art teacher's point of view, how could I not have intended that? Any normal person will notice what they're stepping on, right? Any normal person will not have such a restricted field of attention that all that's visible to them is what's on the desks. But I actually didn't have that. And there was no way to explain to her, look, I'm really sorry, I didn't notice. I mean, how could I begin to explain? Because I ought to have noticed. And school was really, really like that all the time for me. You know, people would expect things, I couldn't do them, I didn't do them, all these misunderstandings. So I think the kinds of accommodations and adaptations that we need to make for siblings who have some autistic traits, really, you ought to be able to accommodate everyone, you know, whether their sibling is autistic or not. You know, everyone is different, everyone has a particular cognitive style. But in the case of the siblings in particular, two things, I think. You know, one is purely academic accommodations, right? You know, so what kind of, are they at a superior reading level? Are they going to get the appropriate reading and literature instruction, this kind of thing? Do they like to do science? Do they like to do computer programming? If so, are they going to have access to the appropriate science curriculum, the appropriate computing curriculum? But at the same time, just everyday expectations, not even necessarily academic expectations, but social ones. Right? I sometimes daydream, okay, you know, one of these days I will meet that art teacher in heaven. Right? I'll finally be able to explain to her, look, I'm really sorry. Or one of these days I will meet that gymnastics teacher. And I'll finally be able to explain, look, I really was trying to do the jumping jacks. Honestly, I was trying, I just couldn't. But we have all of these expectations, and those expectations, both academic and social and attentional, need to be modified for the individual child. And I think the difference when the individual child is a sibling of someone with autism who has some of these autistic traits, and not all siblings do, some of them do, I think that we can know and predict a bit better what kinds of accommodations to make. So again, you know, not expecting things that are difficult or impossible for that child to do. And then also giving that child the appropriate academic opportunities. You know, if the child likes reading, get them to a library, develop that. If the child has difficulty physically writing because of fine motor impairments, okay, see what they can do with a keyboard, right? Put them in front of a computer instead. Make those accommodations, and there are certain traits that are common to autism and to siblings, some siblings. Again, not in degree, but certainly in kind. And we can use those traits. We can use what we know about autism to predict, in some sense, what these siblings of children with autism might be particularly good at and particularly difficult with. So that's a long-winded answer to that question. But yes, brain function does affect the accommodations one should make in all children, and we can predict a lot about it in autistic siblings simply because we know that much more about autism. Okay, so should we go on now, or yes, do we want that break?
We can start. You go to lunch. Lunch, coffee, nothing. Okay, then we can break.
Break now? Okay.